Hi, and welcome to Music Production with Mike and Dan.
I wanted to get into 16-track recording and just sort of talk about, you know, some of the sessions that we've done on 16-track. You recorded at Dancing Dog, right? And the one at 16 with Bryson, right?
Yeah. And so, yeah, one that was like the only, I think I mentioned in a previous podcast, it's like the one recording that I think that we did as a band in a studio that came out really well, that we are all really happy with. I think Dave Bryson is technically listed on credits as the producer, but he was much more of an engineer producer. I don't remember him having any kind of comments about arrangements or anything like that, but he kept the session going and he made it sound really good. It was like one of the few recordings that has energy. It has like, sounds like we meant it, and it has like a really kind of nice live feel to it. So yeah, thanks to him, we have at least one studio recording that we like.
Yeah.
I won't forget you.
And did you guys, so when you did that, because I know how the room was set up and everything, so did you guys do like a rhythm guitar, bass, and drums all at once kind of thing?
I believe so. I think everything went down, what you just said, yeah. And then Paul went back and did his lead guitar, and then I went back and did vocals separate.
Yeah, that seems to be the way, yeah, the way we...
On a separate day.
Right. Right. For me, it was primarily 1-inch 16. I did have a one session where I recorded on 2-inch 16, but most of my 16 tracks were 1-inch.
As I mentioned last time, we did record on a 2-inch 16 track that I'm this guy, Bob, whose recording studio I do not remember. I remember like noticing it sounded really nice and fat. It's one of these situations where we didn't have a producer at all. Bob was purely an engineer. He was a good engineer, but there was nobody but us, and it would have been one those situations where anybody would have been anybody having someone an outside ear on that kind of project would have really helped, because I remember the performances just didn't come across that well. But I remember that was a beautiful, I believe it was a Studer, as I recall, beautiful Studer machine, and he really sold us on it. I didn't really have any knowledge about tape width and all that stuff, and he pretty much told us why it was such a much better format to have a 16 channel over 2-inch than 24 track over 2-inch, because he could swap out the head. I mean, he had to set up the machine differently when he did. It was sort of a big deal, but he could, if somebody wanted to have a 24 track session, he could do that, or 16, but he always stayed on 16 because it sounded so much better.
Yeah, I had this very similar experience with Small Time Napoleons. And at that point, maybe he was even the same guy, but this was 1994. And we went in there. I can't remember what the guy's name was, but it was a very similar situation. Yeah, and I think I don't know if he charged us. It might have just been like a favor. But we only did one song, and it sounded great. We did basics, and I did some guitar overdubs, but we never finished the song. I guess because we could never get back in the studio again. I can't remember why or whatever, but, you know, I still have that track, you know, that's a really good-sounding instrumental. We used to call it the Pretender song. It reminded us of the Pretenders. Uh-huh. Going back to the one-inch stuff, I did a little bit of live drums early on when I still lived in Miami. Mm-hmm. Then I did a few sessions in New York with the Chairs. And then after that, it was just drum machine, drum machine, drum machine. I mean, all of this stuff in Dancing Dog and the 8-track was the Alesis drum machine. And Bryson was there and he said, you know, go into the 16, you know, get a client, go into the 16 and start recording live drums. Because the only way you're going to learn is you got to just do it. You know, that's the only way you're going to learn. And I have to say, like, I really did have a fear of that. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and 16 tracks, I mean, that's one of the big differences. 8-track, it still wasn't really practical to put, you know, how many tracks you're going to dedicate, 6 tracks to drums or whatever it is. It just isn't practical. So with 16, you kind of have a lot of flexibility, and all of a sudden, you can have a lot of tracks and still have plenty of tracks to record a band.
Right.
I mean, it's a big difference between that. And so that's, without 16 tracks, it was a lot more practical to use the drum machine for a lot of things.
We didn't really get much into this when we were talking about 8-tracking, mainly because neither one of us did a lot of live drums with 8-track. But I think the trick in 8-track, when you're doing live drums, is very similar to what you do on the 4-track. You record, you know, kick, snare, overheads, hopefully not too many toms. You know, and you know, maybe a room mic. So you might have like 5 tracks of drums. Maybe you get up to 6 and then you do a stereo bounce of the drums. So you still have, you know, stereo drums. So then your drums are frozen on 7 and 8 for the rest of the session. And then you have 6 tracks to, you know, basically do everything else. But like you said, with 16, it's like, okay, the sun's come out, you know, it's like now we can, you know, we can breathe a little easier. And
yeah, and especially because you had become accustomed to working with 8, which is sort of like, sort of follows the trajectory of what we've been talking about. Because you had all that sort of knowledge about how things worked, and now all of a sudden it opens up and you have twice as many tracks, it makes a big difference. You know, so you don't have to do that frozen stereo bounce, and you have these nice, fresh, first-generation takes that are going to sound a lot better.
Right, exactly. And with that in mind, when I got past that point where I was kind of, you know, nervous about drums, and I realized, oh, I can do this, you know, oh, actually it went pretty well. Oh, you know, this, you know, like I didn't screw anything up. I went through, I don't know how many sessions where it was really just about setting up mics, getting levels, and just recording whatever the drummer brings, you know. Mm-hmm. There was very little time or even thought on my part to try to actually get a drum sound, you know. I mean, the room that we recorded drums in at Dancing Dog was pretty crappy. I mean, that was one of the things about that little ISO room. It just, the dimensions and everything, it just did not have a good sound at all.
It was a box. It was definitely
a very box.
Square box.
Yeah, it sucked. And eventually, as the years went on, I got out of there and I just stopped recording drums in there. And I would put the drums in the recreation area because it was, you know, it was one of those warehouses with those really high concrete ceilings.
Yeah.
And so you got a lot of nice bounce around in there, a lot of really nice early reflection in there. And I started getting pretty good drum sounds in there. And that's, I was trying to get to that, which is, it took a while for me to start thinking, to get comfortable enough recording drums where I said to myself, okay, it's not enough for me anymore just to record drums and not screw it up and just get good levels. Mm-hmm. Now I want to start doing something with the drums that is a sound, and then people know that sound and they identify that sound with my band, which at the time was Green Things. Mm-hmm. And the first song that I felt like I really accomplished that was a song called The Call.
Hey, what was that groove you were playing?
I don't know, man. I think it was something like this.
Tripped up, turned around, tight-lipped coming down. Green things are so fine, all the colors in my mind. I was saved by your call, your rope broke my fall. Turned my frown upside down, put my feet on the ground.
I'm saved by your call. No, 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 no. I'm saved.
That song actually eventually wound up on 90210. you know, like in the TV show.
Oh, wow. That's some 90s stuff there, yeah.
But no, I did get a really cool, unique drum sound. We sort of had like a combination of rock stuff, but then we also got into like Motown grooves. And I wanted to get a drum sound that was, had kind of like dead drums, but not like 1970s dead. Not like Eagles dead or Fleetwood Mac dead.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to get more like Marvin Gaye dead, you know? that's a bad thing to say.
That is definitely like that was of that era. And really close mic'd, isolated drums. That became an option once there was multitrack, once the multitrack was ubiquitous, that everybody could record separate, have a tom on its own track.
Yeah.
That really wasn't an option before.
Right. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even Motown now that I think about it. It was Motown plus other artists, but the one artist I was really thinking of was Al Green.
Mm-hmm.
There's that song, you know, Still in Love with You. Do you know Al Green? Do you know much Al Green stuff? That whole era, I want to say like 1971, he came out with a record that was really good and just had a lot of hits on it. 71, 72-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the drum sound that he got on most of those songs was the drum sound I was trying to get at Dancing Dog. That's the point. And yeah, it was just sort of close mic'd and we really went out of our way to sort of, I think we moved baffles in. Like we really wanted to, you know, we just wanted the drums to be dead. I used enormous amounts of compression, almost to the point where I was limiting it, you know. And it's just, I don't know, it's just like I just kept on tweaking and turning knobs, and I kind of didn't really know what I was doing until I got the sound I wanted. And then I just stopped. I was like, that's it. That's what I'm going for.
So you were just using your ears, and you had the drums isolated, so
yeah.
You hear everything in the control room. And no one really told you, like, where the mic should go and, like, where to point it and anything like that? And
no, nothing like that. As a matter of fact, I had sort of a basic understanding just on, you know, by watching Bryson and other engineers at the studio. But I always like to experiment a little. I always like to, you know, I mean, you know, when you're recording live drums, most people know this, like, one of the big sort of challenges with live drums is getting a least amount of hi-hat in your snare mics, you know, because pulling the hi-hat out of the snares is kind of hard. And then, you know, when you're mixing and when you want to do stuff with the snare and then you're, you know, you want to turn up certain frequencies and then you just wind up getting so much more hi-hat. And it's not even the nice part of the hi-hat, you know, because it would be like somewhere around 4 to 5K that you want in the snare. And that's sort of like a very mid-rangey hi-hat sound. So it took me a really long time, but, you know, I got really good at just knowing where to put that snare mic to get the least amount of hi-hat.
Yeah, I mean, that was the name of the game, is keeping the hi-hat off of the snare mic. And I've been recording sessions where the hi-hat was mic'd, and I don't really remember why or how. I mean, it seems like that's like the last thing you would want to mic. But people, like, depending on how good they were, they would end up miking the hi-hat.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that's sort of where I wanted to go next. Because there's, once again, there's two schools. You know, there's this school of every single thing needs to be mic'd on the drum kit. And I just, man, it gets to a point where you got so many microphones and so many phasing issues. And I don't see the point. And then you listen to the song and the drummer hits like the first of five toms once in this, like in a 5 minute song, and he just hits the ding and that's it. And it's like,
yeah.
It's like, why did I set the, you know? So I started actually getting more and more into fewer mics. And experimenting with fewer mics, you know. I started getting into the first one, I think, was Cunaberti showed me. I think I did a session with him, and he said, okay, we're only going to use three mics on the drums. I was like, three mics on the drums? What the hell? And basically what he was showing me was the Glenn Johns method. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I am very familiar. And it's been disputed. Sometimes he would vary that. Sometimes he would add another, like a close, depending on the song, he would add a closer mic. So it would be an overheads and then a kick drum mic, like kind of out in front of the kick drum.
Yeah, and then the weird one was there was the mic that picks up the snare is actually sort of behind the drummer off to the side, kind of. So it was a really weird placement. Yeah, it was like one directly above facing down, and then one in front of the kick, and then one behind. Let's just say it's a right-handed drummer, one sort of like slightly to the right behind the drummer. Pretty sure that's where it was. And I experimented with that. I did a lot of songs like that, and I just kept on tweaking it. And, you know, in the end, I kind of gave up. You know, I gave up. I do have a lot of examples of that, of songs I've recorded with that setup. We'll be right back. But ultimately, it was just like, you know, I'm getting tired of this kind of semi-stereo sounding drum set that's not really, it doesn't really give you the full stereo spectrum. And it's, I don't know. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So I started getting more into kick snare overheads. And this way I just knew I had a good stereo. Basically, I just stopped miking toms. That was the main thing.
And stuck with the overheads and a close mic on the kick?
Yeah. Close mic kick, one on the snare, stereo overheads. And then I forgot. Yeah, it was five. It was because then I always had a room mic, you know, assuming that the room was worth having a mic in. But usually the room was worth having a mic in. So yeah, it was usually five tracks of drums. And then that left me like 11 tracks on the 16 track, you know? So I was just like, you know, many songs, I didn't even fill up the whole 16, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That was my main go-to setup for a really long time. And also when drummers would come in and they would have, that's the other thing, you know, a lot of this is predicated on the drummer. I mean, that's where it all starts, you know, is the drummer any good?
Yeah.
And does the drummer know how to hit the drums?
Mm-hmm.
Is the drummer flexible enough to do what's required in the studio, even if it's different from what the drummer does live? You know, does the drummer have that skill?
Also, the idea that to have dynamics, being able to play with dynamics and being able to say, hey, should I mic that cymbal? Because I can't really can hear it. Can you play it a little harder? And a good drummer can say, yeah, okay, sorry, I can just hit that a little harder. You know, it's good because they have a different, they can't hear what's going down. Like rock and roll drummers, they play how they play and that's it. But people like professional drummers and really good drummers that I've worked with, they have that ability to sort of turn up and down the kit.
Oh my God, yes. I mean, I have to say the best drummer I ever played with in the studio and maybe even anywhere was Prairie Prince. And my goodness, I mean, I never experienced that ever. Now, I wasn't engineering that. Carl Durfler was engineering and Prairie came in and he just, you know, set up his drums. You know, we were talking, you know, I just said, oh man, you played on Skylarking, you know, because I'm a big XTC fan, you know, and he started playing the beat to Dear God, which was really cool. And I went into the control room, I was sitting next to Carl and he just started hitting the drums. And I looked at Carl and I was like, what did you do? I said, did you just add a bunch of high? He goes, no, I didn't do anything. I was like, that's not, I said, and this is a quote. I said, that's not possible. And he said, yes, it is. And it was just, it was amazing. I mean,
he brought in his own kit though.
Yeah, I think he did. I mean, we hired the drum guy. I don't know. This is Chris Coyle connection.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Bay Area drum guy supposedly that, you know, he just, when you have a record deal and you can afford it, you call this guy. He's kind of like the wolf in Pulp Fiction or something. He's like, you know, the best at what he's like. You just call him and he like, don't worry about it. I've got the wolf, you know? And anyway, he came in and he just had every drum you'd ever want and that kind of stuff. But I think when Prairie came in to play on the songs that he played on, I think he brought his own drums. I'm pretty sure he did.
I see. But the point is that he has so much control over his kit that it was like basically he was kind of mixing himself.
Yeah, it was just like, I got an education that day. Let's just put it that way. I had something to compare other sessions with at that point, like a really high bar to say, okay, now I've experienced something that I've never experienced before, recording a session drummer.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, and Prairie Prince is the top of the list, right? I mean, he is like on the very short list of session player in the Bay Area, if not United States. So he's a really, really... It doesn't get much better.
Right. I'm not a virtuoso either. So I'm not, you know, I'm still on that same level with other, you know, guys just trying to make it, you know, but
right.
I mean, I'm sure it would have been the same if it was a bass player. I mean, I'm a bass player, but if some guy like that on that level came along, I would just be like, holy crap, you know? And that's just, you know, that's just the way it is, you know, when you're, they're just a different breed, you know? I mean,
it's true.
You know, I consider myself to be more of, like, it's like the old Sammy Davis quote. You remember that one? Someone asked Sammy, they said, oh, like, do you consider yourself to be a great dancer or a great singer? And he goes, it depends. And he said, depends on what? And he says, well, I call myself a great dancer, but if Fred Astaire is in the same room, then I say I'm a great singer. Until Frank Sinatra walks in, then I say I'm a great dancer. But of course, Sammy was great, but, you know, in both. But that's, you know, what I'm talking about. If I'm in a room and I think, okay, you know, I can hold my own as a musician, then okay, yeah, I'm a fucking good guitar player, whatever, you know. But when those virtuosos walk in the room, that's like, oh, I'm really a songwriter, actually. I just... Anyway, getting back to the drum thing. So kick drum sounds, snare sounds. It's funny how, like, snares, I sort of went back and forth with top snare, bottom snare. Mm-hmm. Many years I didn't use a bottom snare. I just felt like at the end of the day, how much of that bottom snare am I really going to use? Most of the sound was just the top, you know, with the crack of the snare. But in recent years, I've actually gotten really into bottom snare.
Yeah, it really depends on the track. I would think on a really aggressive rock track would be less important. I probably would help, but like I've noticed, like something has dynamics and gets quiet. I really do like to hear those things rattling around down there.
Yeah, and like I hate to keep on going back to the Beatles, but because it's such an old reference, whenever I think of a snare sound where the snare, not like a cracking snare that, you know, we're all familiar with, you know, that sort of mm-hmm. basic rock snare, but a snare that has the qualities of a snare, like the snare that's like in a marching band kind of
yeah.
thing. And you can hear like the full body of it, and it's bright, but it's not high-endy and piercing. And the example I like to think of is Glass Onion from the White Album.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does, you know, after that, oh yeah, and it was like, they just those flams like, brah, brah, and they're just overdubbed most likely. But I always thought to myself, you know, if I could get a snare sound like that, where you could just hear, like you could almost just like picture the drum in your head when you hear it. It's like, you know, if I needed to get that sound, you know, sort of referencing that and saying, okay, here's a song where I really want to hear more snares, you know, so then I would put the bottom snare mic on because I'm trying to get the snares and have the drummer tune the snare drum down a little so it isn't so smacky and has a little, it's more floppy, you know, it has more of the snare aspect. Or take Pillows out of the kick drum and have it be a little bit more of like a boom, boom kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But only when the song would allow it, because that's the thing about drums. You know, drums are, they're a timekeeping instrument. And a lot of people don't realize this, but it's like you're trying to get a drum sound, but that drum sound doesn't work because the tempo of the song is too fast. So like a lot of people, I remember I was recording this band once, and this guy kept on saying, the drummer kept on saying, oh, get me like When the Levee Breaks. Get me that John Bonham sound.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, dude, if I got you that sound, your drums would sound like mush. Because
you have to play When the Levee Breaks tempo in order for that
right,
to work.
Right, exactly. That's the whole point.
Well, on the Beatles too, that's true. And they would have a lot of mid-tempo songs, and that's why they get away with that. I mean, they weren't nearly as open as Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin is the extreme big drum sounding example.
Yeah.
But they definitely had that because they had so many mid-tempo songs, you could really hear the Tom singing a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what made me realize, okay, wait a minute. Before you start thinking about a drum sound, like first listen to the song and get familiar with the tempo,
mm-hmm.
and then start thinking of like within that tempo, even what room you want to put the drums in. So, you know, if I'm recording a punk band and all the songs are like 200 beats per minute or something like that, then I want a very short, early reflection, almost bathroom sound, you know, at the most, you know, mm-hmm. maybe not even that.
Yeah, you're totally... Dead would work too, yeah, depending on
right,
the band.
Exactly. The deader, the better, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you get into like a slow ballad, then it's like, oh my God, now I've got all these options. Like, let's go to that room where there's like the big brick wall and it's like, and it's all natural reverb. You know, you use the room based on, you know, the tempo. Now, a lot of people don't have the luxury of that. But if you do have access to, let's just say, three different rooms, you know, the room that I use here at my house, my living room, is really good for mid-tempo and slow, actually. But when the songs get to be a little bit faster, then, you know, I prefer to put the drums in my garage, which is more dead. So I have those two options. Actually, three options.
In your current situation?
Yeah, my current situation.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool. Yeah, no, your drums, yeah, from whatever that last thing was, they were studio perfect.
That's my approach to it. I remember one time somebody said, you know, well, you know, these guys, they were talking about some session. He said, oh, you know, they spent like 2 days trying to get a kick drum sound, but I'll bet you the songwriter didn't even spend that long on the lyrics to the song, you know? And so, you know, so like that's the other, you know, example. Like you have to keep that stuff in mind. You know, you have to balance it out is what I'm saying. You know, you want to spend enough time on it, get an interesting sound, but then you also don't want to lose perspective of the whole thing, you know?
Well, there was, I mean, and there was a time, and I don't know if you want to talk about this now, but there was a time, I mean, it's much less of important to get, there's a sound that's in the air right now, and like, in order to get the sound that everybody wants to hear on the records at that time, it became like sort of, there was ways to do it, and if you didn't have that, you would keep working on it till you had the sound,
right?
You know, and so, and there, and that, you know, the 80s had their own sound for drums, and the 90s had their own sound for drums. I mean, that's when you're talking about these big rooms that you're talking about. I'm thinking, oh, that must be the 90s, because that was, you know, in the 80s, it was all about gated stuff. And like, you would have a big room, you would gate it out. But it's so in order to get the sound, it took a lot of time. It took some science, and there is meters involved and a lot of things to get the sound. Nowadays, it seems like it's a lot less of a, I don't really have a handle on what drums sound like exactly. There's so much going on. Everything's on shuffle, and there's a lot of eclectic. There's a lot of different types of sounds out there right now. I'm not sure it's quite so rigid.
Yeah, it's really become a hodgepodge. And, you know, I think in addition to the sound of drums, and, you know, we talked about this before, and we both said, you know, oh, I could tell you almost what year that song was recorded by just listening to the drums.
Yeah, specifically the snare. It's like, that's the thing. And kick. I know, like with dubstep, there was all this, like, there was a really specific sound with the kick and snare, but that's not quite sort of in the conversation quite so much anymore.
Right. And I was going to say, like, with those different sounds, there was also sort of the beat. Like, I mean, and sometimes it was more than one, but, you know, there was a certain beat in the 60s, mainly coming from Motown and soul and that kind of stuff that, of course, white people started, you know, copying and, you know, making, you know, trying to bring that into white rock, you know?
Yeah.
And there was a beat, you know, we used to call it the James Brown beat, you know, that sort of ghost notes on the snare thing. Dun-dun bat, 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 dun bat, like that kind of thing. And that came back in the 90s. That was something the Green Things was really into. Like, a lot of our beats have that beat.
Well, and it was a break. It was also, that was probably taken from break beats. And that was one of the first early breaks that got sampled and put into breakbeat songs.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was everywhere. Yeah. There was a point where I was wanting to incur fines on any band that used that beat, because it was like, no, you can't. That's, we've heard that,
I know,
too much.
It's been done. Yeah. And the first time I heard it in a non soul sort of like, you know, James Brown, Motown kind of stuff, the first time I heard it being recycled, you know, and used in an innovative way, was the Cocteau Twins, you know, Bluebell Knoll, when there's that that middle break where, like, there's no drums in the song, and then out of nowhere the drums come in and it's that beat, you know, dun dun ba 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 dun ba dun boom ba 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 dun, and I was like, oh my god, what a great idea to bring that beat back with this kind of sound. It was the fusion of it that I thought made it so cool. And from that point—
But that was a very deliberate recontextualization of that beat. And so it wasn't just because they couldn't think of anything. No. They wanted, that was a deliberate move.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it was genius in my, you know, in my opinion. You know, like I said, my band used it, so we were guilty of that. So there's the beats. Of course, there's the disco beats in the 70s, you know, with the very busy hi-hat stuff and just really simple kick and snare. So there was that, you know, that's a trademark sound of that time.
That's true.
And then I would say today there's a beat. I don't really know what it's called, but I hear it and I hear it a lot. It's been annoying me for a while now. And it's primarily in pop music. And it goes like this. It goes boom, ba, 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 doom, ba, 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 doom, ba, 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 doom. When you hear cars driving by, and it's not just one band. I mean, it's like, it's been around now, I want to say, for over 10 years, maybe 10 years. And that's sort of the cool beat. It's probably on its way out now.
Yeah, no, but you're right. There is, like, there's certain breaks. I mean, it's a sample, or it's like, or it's a break that somebody has taken. But yeah, that's definitely, I hear that. I'm not sure if there's a name for it or anything like that. But yeah, you're right. There is still very much trendy kind of beats, or sort of like patterns that come up. Yeah, so that's still something that goes on all the time.
I think it's an infusion of Latin. I think that's, it's supposed to be a Latin inspired or influenced beat. But I'm Latin and I
right, but it's in pop songs. It's like really
exactly. It's not Latin music. It's just, I think that was the idea, was, oh yeah, let's make it a little spicy, like picante or something, like let's get the Latin beat in here, you know. And I grew up listening to salsa music, you know. I'm half Puerto Rican, you know, and you know, I know the difference, you know. I know the authentic stuff, and I can hear that. Okay, I can see what they're trying. It's a very watered down, straightened, sort of with a little bit of Latin thrown in. It would be like fast food Latin versus going to a real Latin restaurant, you know, like that's the difference.
But the songs you're talking about aren't even remotely Latin.
No, they're just pop. Yeah. And some of them are like, they have like, you know, it's like rap and then, you know, some singing or whatever, you know, it's, you know, the stuff that's out today. I don't know if the listeners know the story, but how the gated reverb started, which was an accident in with the Phil Collins.
Do you ever wonder if it's like somebody just made it up or just...
Do you think it's made up?
It's such a good... No, but it's like, it's occurred to me because it's like so ubiquitous. So the thing is that there was, it was the talkback mic, right? And there's a, they had a gate on the talkback mic so the people in the control room wouldn't necessarily hear everything. They'd only hear only the loud things in the room.
Right.
And so there'd be a gate that would cut that off and then, and so cut off all the room sound in a sort of, I guess, in a interesting way.
Yeah, I think it was Hugh Padgham and Steve Lillywhite, I think, were the producer and engineer on that session.
Yeah, they're the ones that are credited with that sound, for better or worse. Yeah.
And they
all got sick of that sound.
They had just gotten the new SSL board and they were figuring it out. And so Phil Collins was just hitting his drums randomly. And then what they heard over the talkback mic, because the gate wasn't set to anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was just sort of where it was. And it just happened to create that sound with the really short gate. So it was a big enough room. And then the gate closed quickly. And they just thought, wow, we should use that. So they wound up using it on the I Can Hear It Coming Now, whatever. And that really famous drum break that everyone references now. You know, since we were on this topic of the whole gated sound, is reverb on kick drum, which is something that a lot of people don't do. But I started getting into that too. There were certain songs where I thought, no, like trying to create a room, or actually it would be even like more like a hallway, you know, where like, let's say someone's playing drums in a rehearsal space and the door is open. Because a lot of times, you know, you're moving your gear in or whatever, and the drummer's just hitting the drums. And as you're walking in the hallway towards your room and the door is open, you can really hear that hall reverb, you know?
Yeah.
So my goal was to sort of simulate that, like in a song. And of course, it's not just the snare that has reverb, you know? The kick, if the snare has it, the kick has it too. It's the whole drum set, you know? So once again, it was a tempo thing and I had to, you know, it had to be a song where it would work, you know, where there would, the drums could, I could do that with the drums and get that kind of sound, you know.
It's pretty weird. It's pretty unheard of to put, you know, onboard reverb onto a kick drum.
Yeah.
I mean, Led Zeppelin, that was all natural.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. You're trying to make it seem like natural.
But it really depends on the song.
It does. It totally depends on the song. So,
yeah.
But yeah, so that's a sort of a little bit of like what I like to do and the sounds I'm trying to get. And usually I would say my rule book is know the song first. First and foremost, know the song and get familiar with the tempo and then start thinking of room sizes that you would want to use for each song.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have that luxury, a lot of people don't. And then once you've got all that figured out, then start tweaking with, okay, can we get more of a room sound out of the kick? Can we get more of a room sound out of the snare or that kind of thing? Because that's another thing. Moving that room mic around is a really big part of getting a really good complete drum sound.
Yeah.
A lot of my drum sounds really come from the room mic, even though everything else is close mic'd, but that room mic is really, that's my effects, you know, because I don't really put effects on drums anymore. I just use the room mic. You can move that room mic just a few inches one way or the other, and all of a sudden it's a kick dominant sound. Now, you know, your room mic is now more about the kick, and then you just tweak it a little bit off to another side, and now it's more about the snare.
So you can do sort of live mixing before you even start going with that room mic.
Yeah. It's kind of like I said in episode one about, you know, doing a little bit of pre-mixing by just moving a mic around.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people like to use stereo rooms and that's good too. I don't really mess much with stereo room, mainly because I just don't have another really good mic. You need two really nice mics to do that. I only have one really nice vocal mic. And yeah, and then, you know, once you've got all that, then it's just a matter of, you know, getting the levels. I don't want to get into gear and start talking about like all the input chain stuff. Let's save that for another time.
Okay.
We use the 16 track to sort of get into drums, which is more where we want to take this podcast in the future is more like this episode, where we're talking more about techniques and production ideas and things like that.
What kind of car did he drive? Do you know? Do you remember that?
A 54 Chevy.
Oh, cool. What color?
It was like aqua and green. It was really cool. It was a really cool color scheme. And it was the original color scheme, actually.
You digress so easily.
Now I look inside myself. Lots of love, but not much in wealth.
If you like this podcast, please subscribe. Leave us 5 stars and a review. Thanks.
If you want, I can analyze you. I can tell you what you want me to.